Thanks very much for the introduction, and thanks for inviting me here today. I work at Prowler.io, which is a startup company which is based in Cambridge, down on the Hills Road. I used to work in academia, and I got a bit fed up and left. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is how I use Gaussian processes in machine learning. So from the theme of this workshop, I get the idea that a lot of you guys do Krigging for doing computer emulation. And a lot of what we're talking about is how to do sort of computationally efficient things in that area. So I'm going to talk about how I do computationally efficient things with Gaussian processes and machine learning. And the talk has three sort of sections. I have a sort of technical bit to start with that explains how I think about doing approximate Gaussian process inference. And then there's a little bit in the middle where I'm going to do, with some risk, I'm going to show you a live demo of how the software package GPFlow works. I just want to give you a flavor of what's going on and why I think it's an exciting way to do computing. And then finally, if I've got some time, I will show you a few examples of the kind of things that we do with Gaussian process models at Prowler. Okay, so here's my first section. What kind of things do people in machine learning do with Gaussian processes? Well, here's a really simple example. I have two inputs and one response variable, and the response variable is this binary. It's blue or purple. And what machine learning people are usually interested in is, if I have another point, is it going to be blue or purple? And what they're usually doing is, instead of having a two-dimensional input, they have an image, and they want to say, is this a cat or is it a dog? Or is this really the person who should be unlocking this iPhone, or is it not? And you can do this with the Gaussian process. You just you have to do a few little tricks. Another thing you might be interested in is somebody gives you a data set and you want to do some interpolation, a bit like I'm showing you here with the Gaussian process, but you might have some outliers. And again, you want to have some kind of non-Gaussian model which involves the Gaussian process in some way. How do we cope with that? And the big thing in Gaussian processes, or the reason that most people don't like Gaussian processes in machine learning, is you have to compute this big kernel matrix. And the kernel matrix is number of data points by number of data points, and then you have to solve this kernel matrix. And that's a bit frustrating, because with the number of data points is large, that gets expensive. So I'm going to show you how we avoid doing that problem, and get around this non-Gaussian problem as well at the same time, using a simple machine learning sort of method. So to understand what's happening here, let's have a quick recap of what happens when we're doing Gaussian process regression. So I think of Gaussian processes as a prior distribution on functions. So this is my picture of a prior distribution on functions. Every little blue line is one function that's under the prior somewhere. And when I generate a data set using this, I say, well, I picked a function from the prior. That's this purple function. I don't get to see all the other functions. And in fact, I don't get to see this function either. I just get to see evaluations of that function at some points. And probably I don't get to see evaluations of the function directly. Maybe I get noisy evaluations of the function. So I don't get to see the function. I just get to see this data set. And the goal is, work out what was the original purple function. So this is a Bayesian inference problem, and the only thing that's a little bit special about this Bayesian inference problem is I have this non-parametric object in there. I have this function, or this distribution on functions there in the model. So the cool thing about Gaussian processes that I think most people in this room know is that you can solve this problem in closed form. There's just a little equation that says, you know, k inverse y, and boom, you're done. And this is a really attractive thing to machine learning people. Rather than having to do some kind of iterative procedure, you can just say, boom, I can now interpolate all my data points. If you're doing classification, though, you can't do that quite so easily. So here's the sort of analogous process for classification. Here's my prior over functions, and I pick one function from this prior over function, that's my purple function again. And what I do this time is I squash that function. So I take this this y-axis goes from minus infinity to infinity, and I pass it through some sigmoidal function, a logistic sigmoid, for example, and I end up with this red line here, which is somewhere between 0 and 1. And I don't get observations of that. There are a series of points on the x-axis where this thing gets evaluated, and then I flip a biased coin at every data point whose bias is given by whatever the red dot is, and then I get some ones or some zeros out, and that's my data set. And the goal is the same as it was in TP regression. I want to know what was the original function. So I have to do some, turn the Bayesian handle and say, well, what is my posterior distribution over functions given this data set? And this turned out to be harder, right? There's no closed form solution for exactly how to do that. So what I'm showing you here is my posterior distribution on functions in blue and my posterior distribution on the squashed functions in red. And machine learning people like this because they can then say, well, given a new x input, what's the probability this is going to be a 1 or a 0? So there's been an awful lot of work in Gaussian processes to try to make them work for large data applications. There's a small herd of machine learning researchers who really think that Gaussian processes are a really elegant way to treat functions. And they are constantly pelted by the neural network community who have amazing numerical results. And one of the sort of goals of the last 10 years has been to say, well, how do I apply this Gaussian process methodology when I have millions and millions of data points? I can't even store the kernel matrix, let alone solve it. And the main thing that's going on here is I have this non-parametric prior. I write this as P of F of dot. You have to excuse my sort of mathematical abuse of the notation here. That sort of implies I have a measure on a function. But the intuition is pretty good with this notation. And the way that we deal with the Gaussian process is that we say, well, I can factor this prior on functions into a prior on functions given the value of the function at some points, and I call that vector f, and give some prior distribution for the function values at f. And if I make the vector f all of the places where I have data, then I can compute with this thing nice and concisely. But if f is really big, then everything is very expensive to compute with, and I'd like to avoid having to do that. So here's a small detour into something called variational Bayes. So variational Bayes is the mechanism that we're going to use to try to solve this problem. So we want to avoid computing this big kernel matrix, and we want to be able to deal with non-Gaussian data in our Gaussian process problem. And variational Bayes is this machine learning technique for doing approximate inference. We have to make some kind of approximation in our model. We can't compute the posterior exactly. And there are many choices that we could make. We could do some kind of Markov chain Monte Carlo. That would give us an approximate posterior. Our choice is variational Bayes. And I'm very happy to talk about the pros and cons of that if you want to discuss later. So what I'm going to do is show you for about 5 slides what variational Bayes is and how it works and how it makes the whole problem much, much easier. And I'll show you that using a very simple toy example, and then I'll apply it back to Gaussian processes and show how it works in that context in about 5 slides time. Here is the canonical picture of Bayesian inference that you'll find in all textbooks. I've colored things to make it easier, so I have a purple prior, a blue likelihood, and a green posterior distribution. And we'd love to be able to get at the posterior distribution. So the two objects that I don't have are the posterior distribution and the marginal likelihood, or the normalizing constant P of Y. And what variational Bayes says is, let's approximate the posterior distribution, which is P of X given Y, with some other distribution which has some parameters. So here we have the distribution cube of x is going to be a Gaussian distribution by choice, and it has mean m and variance sigma squared. And that mean and sigma squared values, those are parameters of my problem. I'm going to adjust those, I'm going to wiggle those around until I'm satisfied that q of x is sufficiently close to p of x given y. So how do I do that? How do I define P of X given Y and Q of X? How do I define how close they are? I use this callback library divergence, which is this functional that takes in two probability distributions and spits out a number. And it's telling you how close are these two distributions. And when this is zero, I know that I've solved the problem. I'm never going to get it to zero in practice, but I'm going to try to drive it as small as possible. And the chicken and the egg problem here is, well, I want to make this KL divergence really, really small, but I don't know one of the arguments to the KL divergence. I don't know that green thing, the posterior distribution. So how am I going to make use of this at all? So there's a really neat trick. So we write down the definition of the callback library divergence, which is like this, and we substitute in Bayes' rule. So now I substitute my posterior distribution for the ratio of the likelihood times the prior divided by the marginal likelihood. Should be fairly straightforward to follow what's going on there. And then I say, well, this marginal thing, P of Y, is not a function of is not a function of X, so I can move it outside the integral. And now I have something inside this integral which is a function of Q of X, and I have this this log P of Y, which is a constant as far as Q of X is concerned. So this term which involves the integral of X, we call that the elbow, or the evidence lower bound. This is the objective function. And what we'd like to do is, we're going to minimize that term, ignoring log P of Y, but because log P of Y is constant, this is a reasonable proxy for minimizing the callback library divergence. So the minimum of the negative elbow term is the minimum of the KL term. And it only contains things that we know how to deal with. It only contains Q of X, P of Y given X, the likelihood, and P of X, the prior. This is what it looks like in practice. So here's that simple example again. I've got this green distribution, which is my posterior, and I've initialized my approximating Gaussian thing at some random point, and I do gradient-based optimization on the mean and variance of this Gaussian distribution until it's as close to the posterior as it can be. And this is a good point to say, even when I've optimized this thing, the approximation is pretty cruddy. I've sort of captured roughly where the mass of the distribution is, but the tail behavior of my approximation really doesn't match the tail behavior of the real posterior distribution. Pretty nasty approximation. Sometimes that's as good as you're going to be able to do. Sometimes if you want to fit a Gaussian process to millions of data points, this is the kind of thing you're going to have to live with. The other thing to say is, this is a great place to start, right? We could get closer to that green distribution if we just made the red distribution more flexible. The metric for measuring how close these things are is still a good one. The only restriction is I forced us to use Gaussian distributions. What if I used a mixture of Gaussian distributions? Or what if I transformed a Gaussian distribution through some monotonic nonlinearity? These are the kind of open questions in this kind of research at the moment. But for now, we'll say we're going to stick with this Gaussian thing. Okay, so I promised I would come back to how we do this with a Gaussian process. So the answer is, we do almost exactly this, but instead of optimizing over a Gaussian distribution, we optimize over a Gaussian process distribution. And the key ingredient is, how do you parameterize that Gaussian process distribution to make it sufficiently flexible that it can really represent the posterior of the thing that we're interested in? That's what I'm going to try to explain. So the kind of models that we're interested in don't look too different to that silly example I showed you a second ago. But instead of having a Gaussian prior, now I have a Gaussian process prior. And instead of having a very simple one-dimensional likelihood function, I have maybe many data points, which I index I, given different values of the function. I still don't know the posterior distribution, but it's now a posterior distribution over functions. I don't know the marginal likelihood. And what I'm going to do is say, well, there's this family of Gaussian processes, Q of functions. It's going to have some parameters, which I'll explain in just a second. And I'm going to wiggle this Gaussian process distribution around until it looks like the posterior distribution on functions, just like I did for the one-dimensional example. The trick to making this work is picking a really good approximating distribution over functions. That's what's happening here. So whenever we do inference in a Gaussian process, we sort of implicitly forget that there are an infinite number of random variables. We apply this top equation without really thinking that we're doing it. We say, well, we have n data points, and so they are multivariate normal correlated, right? But there are all these other data points that we've marginalized off. And we only consider those again when we say, oh, I want to predict outside my training set. So what we're going to do is consider all of those points in the same kind of structure to make our approximating distribution with. So you might recognize the middle equation here as the Gaussian process predictive equation, or the Krigging predictive equation. So if I have some points f observed at some points x, then you recognize k of dot and x, k inverse f, as the mean predictor equation. And you recognize k of dot and dot minus k of la 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 as the predictive variance equation. So I'm going to take this expression, and I'm going to adjust it to suit my needs to make some form of q. So I'm going to pick some point z, and the z point is going to live in the same input domain as the Gaussian process has. And I'm going to put those into this expression up here. And I'm going to call these values at this point u. And I'm going to use the same sort of conditional Gaussian process form to get the Gaussian process behavior that I wanted in the first place. And additionally, I'm going to introduce some parameters m and l, which are parameters of this multivariate normal. And when I plug them all together, I end up with this Gaussian process, which looks like some kind of mean predictor equation over there on the left, and some kind of adjustable variance equation over here on the right. And I can move this expression around by changing z, by changing m, and by changing l, to get me different Gaussian process distributions. And my plan is to adjust those parameters using variational ways such that this Q of f is a good approximation to the posterior. Let's have a little look at what that kind of means. So this is a picture of my Q distribution. Here I picked to have 1, 2, 3, 4 points m, four support points for the process. And as I move the vector m around, you can see that I'm moving the value of the function around. Fairly straightforward. And as I move this matrix L around, I can change the sort of posterior variance, or the variance of this process around. And as I move the positions of these support points around, I can move how the process is responding over different parts of the space. So I set up my elbow equation, and I throw this thing into an optimizer, and I say, well, minimize this callback Lyapunov divergence with respect to those things. So here's this problem from earlier where I said I had this Gaussian process classification. I've got these ones and these zeros, and here I've got just 5 support points, and this looks like machine learning now. I have some objective function that I want to optimize. I plug this into a machine learning framework, and this moves my distributional functions close to the posterior in some way. So there's some cool things about the objective function. One of them is that it factorizes in the data points. So this is a slightly bizarre thing, because we think about Gaussian processes as being fully correlated things. But because the noise distribution P of Y given F factorizes in the data points, the computation that I have to do can be distributed amongst the data points. Which means I can use distributed computing, or I can use what machine learning people call mini batches, so stochastic optimization, where I randomly sample chunks of the data unoptimized like that. There's this rather interesting looking quantity up here, log p of f of dot over q of f of dot. So this expression is the callback Lyapunov divergence between processes. So I am making horrible abuses of the notation here, but you can actually compute the callback Lyapunov divergence between two Gaussian processes if you construct them like this and they have the same kernel. It's a rather long and involved derivation, but I'd love to talk to somebody if you're interested in talking about that afterwards. Okay, so this is a really good point for me to ask myself some questions. So whenever I'm showing this to new people, they say, well, wait a second, what's going on here? So I've anticipated some of your questions. Here are some of them. What about the parameters of the kernel? What about the length scale and the variance of the kernel? What are you doing with those? Are they given? Well, yeah, this process works nicely if they're given, but one of the byproducts of this variational method is a lower bound on the likelihood, on the probability of the data given the parameters of the kernel. And I can use this as a proxy and do approximate maximum likelihood estimation for those guys. A massive question is, how many Z should I pick? How many of these points, these support points, should I have in my approximation? And my answer is, how big is your computer? If you have 1 million data points, if you really think that the function you're trying to approximate has 1 million wiggles in it, 1 million degrees of freedom, I can't help you. If there really is that much complexity in the data set, there's nothing I can do. But if there really is some smoothness, then we can get away with far fewer Z than we have X, with far fewer support points than we have data points. And there's a really nice property in picking this number of Z. Because the problem is nested, so as I add more of these support points Z, I can always capture the solution that I had with N minus 1. That means adding more support points can never get me a worse solution, aside from local minima in the optimization process. But it means that I've got a very practical way to pick the number of Z. I can say, let's start with 500, because that fits easily on my laptop. And let's see what the solution looks like, and then let's try 550. And if the solution doesn't change, then we know that we're good enough, because we know that the function is monotone in the size of Z. How reasonable is the Gaussian assumption? So I've sort of made this Gaussian process approximation to a non-Gaussian process thing. It's not a very good approximation, but it does work really well in practice. If all you're interested in is predictive performance, it works pretty well. And I do think it's a really interesting area for research, how to make these things much more flexible in their distribution. What if the likelihood doesn't factorize? So what if you have something like a Cox process, where the data depend on some integral of the Gaussian process? I have no idea. I would love to be able to solve that kind of problem. What if the likelihood is Gaussian? Well, there are some neat mathematical tricks you can do there. You can actually solve some of these optimization problems in closed form, which sort of takes you, it's like a single Newton step to the solution, if you like. So there's some extra tricks if you think there's only Gaussian noise on the problem. And then, of course, our Gaussian approximation or our Gaussian assumption is fairly reasonable. Okay, that's sort of the end of that section. I said I wanted to brave a quick live demo. Okay. Let me make this big so you can see what's happening. Is that legible at the back? Yeah? Okay. Has anybody in here ever used a software package called TensorFlow? One, two. Okay. I think, so TensorFlow is a package from Google for doing deep learning. But it can do an awful lot of things that are not deep learning, and I think lots of people should be interested in it. I don't work for Google. I don't have any affiliation with this package. There are several other packages that do very similar things. But I just want to show you the way that this thing computes so that I can explain how I use this in these Gaussian process models. So this is my Python shell, and you can do things like that with this just like you would do in any other language. So I can do something like this. Looks pretty standard. This is how most Python things are computed. TensorFlow does something a little bit different. So in TensorFlow, you do something like this. So what's happening here is I'm saying, make me an object A, and I'll give you some data for that object later. and the same for B. And then I write some expression, C is A plus 2B plus A cubed. And C is just some tensor, so C is just some representation of this computational graph. And to run this thing, I have to do, I have to invoke a session. Like this, and it gives me the answer. This seems like a fairly roundabout way of doing computing, but there are lots of advantages. The first advantage is the smart guys at Google can reason with this object C. So once it has this object C, and you've told the system, this is what I want to compute, be it the elbow of my Gaussian process, or the kernel matrix, or whatever else it is, these guys can take this thing and distribute it across multiple machines. Or they can say, compute this bit of the graph on the GPU that you've got available and send this bit of here off to the cloud. They can do other nice things with it, like do monitoring of the computation as it goes along and give you a nice log of what's happening. And the other cool thing they can do with it is they can differentiate it. So you can do something like, so I can compute the derivative of C with respect to A. And the result is not a symbolic result. It doesn't know how to differentiate a polynomial. It just looks at the graph, and it does a graph-wise differentiation, an automatic differentiation. So you can never get out of this. The derivative with respect to A is 3A squared. It's just a graph that says, compute all the way to C, and then reverse that computation in a special way it gets to the derivative of C with respect to A. So automatic differentiation is pretty cool, and I can do things like this with it now. So I can say, what is the derivative of this expression where at the point where A is 3 and B is equal to 5? And you can compute this thing for me. So hopefully you can quickly see how not having your PhD student or being a PhD student and not having to write down any derivatives anymore, ever, saves an enormous amount of time. I don't know about you, but during my PhD, I got really, really good at doing vector calculus because I wanted to differentiate stuff. And now you just like, boop, give me the gradients, and it's done. Okay, so why is this? How is this connected to Gaussian processes? Well, there's a software package called GPflow, or Gaussian processes in TensorFlow, and we use this thing for doing computation in GPs. So we leverage this TensorFlow computational framework to do computation in Gaussian process models. Let me show you an example. Let's make a very silly data set with 10,000 points in it. So here's a really simple function. Here's a really silly function with 10,000 data points in this little wiggly thing like that. And we'd like to do some Gaussian process regression on this. We write something like this line here. So this is saying use the SGPR model, or the sparse Gaussian process regression model. So that's the sort of technology I was showing you a second ago. You define the kernel by saying I want gpflow.matern32, a sensible choice, I hope you agree. And you tell it what a good guess at some support points might be. You make an optimizer, and you tell this thing to optimize the model. I hope that it works. Yeah, it seems pretty good. And you can ask the model what it looks like. So here is a sort of spew of all the things that are happening in the model, but it can show you what the variance is doing right now, the kernel variance is doing, it seems like a very big number, and what the length scale is doing as well, and what the sort of nugget term, what I call the likelihood variance, is doing as well. So now I can do something like this, and ask this thing to make a prediction. Okay. That seems pretty sensible to me. So we've ended up in a rather nasty sort of local optima of the Gaussian process problem, where we've got chosen a very high variance and a reasonable, fairly long length scale as well. But you can see this thing has solved the problem in just a couple of seconds on my laptop with 10,000 data points. It's very straightforward to implement all kinds of Gaussian process models here for regression, for classification, for with and without nugget terms, and you get all of this nice Google-type computation for free. Just a second. Okay, I've got five minutes? Okay.
Excuse me.
So if you'll excuse me, I'll just use these 5 minutes to show you some of the really cool stuff we can do with this software package and some of the stuff we're doing at my company.
How many Zs?
In the example I just showed you, it was 10. So it was really tiny. So if you're running it in live on a thing and you wanted to solve in 5 seconds, 10 is a good choice. But in practice, we use typically, we pick numbers like 1,000 or 2,000. If you have a really big problem with many data points, then those are the kind of numbers that we're choosing. So we find that we get... there's a sort of technical thing going on here, which is... the parameters Z are part of the approximation, and they're not part of the model. This is a really important and subtle distinction. So lots of other people have techniques that look similar, and they say, well, here's my approximation to the kernel matrix using some support points. And they say, well, you know, I make sure that my kernel matrix is close. And I think, well, approximating the kernel matrix seems like a really bad idea, because I don't know how... You know, small errors in the kernel matrix could be really big errors in the inverse of the kernel matrix, or could be really big errors in the prediction. You really have no idea. Seems like the wrong thing to be targeting to me. I think what we really care about is the predicted distributional, posterior distributional functions, and we target that directly. So there is some, there's this subtlety here that, yeah, it looks an awful lot like projective processes or sparse Gaussian process type methods, right? But it doesn't suffer some of the fallacies that you get with those methods. Okay. I've got 5 minutes. I'd love to talk about this thing. So I alluded earlier to this idea that there's a group of people in the machine learning community who love Gaussian processes and think they're great. And they are bombarded by the neural networks community. Everybody here has heard of deep learning. Everybody in Cambridge knows what deep learning is. And one of the sort of core bits of technology in deep learning is this convolutional network. So when Google recognizes your face with its iPhone or all the other nefarious things that they do, they're using this thing called a convnet. And it's a neural network that takes in an image and it has patches that it scans across the image and it pulls out patch-based features. Or it does translational invariant modeling of the image. And what we were interested in is how can we encode that kind of model inside a kernel? How can we get a Gaussian process model that has a convolutional structure in the kernel? So I did this work with Mark van der Vilk, who was a PhD student in Cambridge and now works in my team at Prowler. So what we did was we said, suppose we want to take an image like this handwritten 6 in the top left corner, and let's break this image down into all possible overlapping pictures, all possible overlapping patches in the image, and define a function g whose input is one of these patches. And let's take a weighted sum of that function evaluated at all patches in the image. So this first line hints as f of x is the sum over p. I'm saying the function on the whole image is the sum of all patches in the image of some weight times some Gaussian process G applied at that patch. And of course, we're doing a linear thing with the Gaussian process. We're doing sums of Gaussian process evaluations. So we know that the result must be another Gaussian process. And the kernel of that new Gaussian process is this thing in the middle line here, which says k of x and x prime. So it computes the kernel of this new Gaussian process, which takes one image and another image and tells you how similar they are. We have to sum over all patches in the first image and all patches in the second image and compute the original kernel between patches and sum over all of these things. This is a really nasty thing. So if we have 10,000 images and they are very low resolution, 28 by 28, then we need to do an enormous number of computations in order to be able to compute just one element of that kernel matrix. So this is sort of doubly intractable now. Not only can I not compute the, because I have too many data points in the traditional Gaussian process form, I now can't even compute elements of the kernel matrix. It's too expensive. So what do you do? Well, we took the same ideas as I was showing you and said, instead of taking points in the function, those red bars that I was moving around earlier, let's make those red bars in the original function g. And then it turns out that all I need to be able to compute is the cross variance between points in the original function g and points in the function f, which is given by the single convolution on the bottom line here down here. So my computational complexity now is sort of involves a single convolution, which is kind of acceptable. So how does it work? Well, we train this thing using the method that I just showed you, but with this particular special kernel structure, and we have 10 labels. This is a very classic machine learning problem. I have 10 different types of digit. I want to build a system that says this is a 6, or is it an 8, or a 0. So I have 10 Gaussian processes, and then some multi-class likelihood on top of them. And what I'm showing you here is how each of the 10 different G functions respond to this image in the top left. So the first function, which I've labeled 0, is the function that is supposed to be high whenever the target label is 0. So I feed the 6 in, and it thinks that some parts of the image really do look like a 6. So here, this thing is very red, which kind of implies that this part of the image looks like it could be a 0, which is plausible, right? You could well have a 0 that sort of went around over there. But this part of the image over here is blue, and that says, well, this feature over here, this thing at the end here, well, you never get that when there's a 0. So it's kind of downweighting this function. And if you look over here, where we really get a 6, it's saying this part of the image, this part of the image, and this part of the image really look like they came from a 6. And of course, this thing has the highest score, and eventually I push this through some kind of softmax representation to get a probability of it being a 6, and it labels this image as a 6. Let me show you just one other thing that we're doing at Prowler. This is one of my researchers, Vincent Dudoir. We're interested in modeling processes that have very non-Gaussian behavior on the output. So here's an example where I have a system with one input x and two responses y1 and y2, and the density of y1 and y2 changes as a function of x in a very non-Gaussian way. So I'm showing this red patch here, which has no data inside it, and I'm showing you these slices through the response function in blue, and you can see that the response of the data is this kind of cone with a sort of peg in the middle. And even though I don't have any data in the red region, I can interpolate the data either side and get this cone like this. So how do we do that with Gaussian processes in this framework that I've shown you? Well, we have latent variables attached to every data point. So now we have a Gaussian process that maps from x and an unknown quantity to y1 and y2 variables, independent Gaussian processes for y1 and y2. And not only do we have to learn the Gaussian processes in the way that I've shown you, we also have to learn what the latent variable associated with every data point is. And the result is it's a kind of model like that looks a little bit like this. And we're motivated to do this by trying to model where people take taxi rides. So this is a map of Porto, and this is the river down here flowing through the city. There are some bars over here and the city center over here. And our model here takes in the time and location of the beginning of a taxi ride and is trying to predict the destination. So you can see this is not a regression problem. There's no way that you can sort of regress the target of a taxi ride on where people took a taxi from. There has to be some very complicated multivariate distribution on the output. So as Vincent is clicking around the map here, the orange dot is showing you the origin of the taxi ride, and the heat map is showing you the distribution of where we think people are going to take a taxi ride to. So most people take a taxi ride to here, the city center, but at different times of day, and depending on where you start your taxi ride, you might have different distributions of where you might want to go to. I think that's a good place to stop and take some questions.
Does anybody have any questions?
Yes, please, Bruno.
So in the simple Python demo you made, you said you took 10 points so that it runs fast here. So those 10 points, I did not get the philosophy how to get the Z points. Assuming you know how many, but how do you select them out of the very big data?
How do I select them?
What is the rationale?
That's the cool thing. They're part of the optimization problem. I didn't select them. I initialized them randomly, but they're parameters. They're parameters of the approximation. So because... I'm not even in the right presentation. Hold on. Where did this thing go?
Okay.
So I set up this callback library versions to say how similar are my... maybe this is a good slide to go with. Nope, that's not working. I'll try to explain. So I set up this elbow, or this objective function that said, make my posterior distribution over Gaussian processes, my approximate posterior distribution, really close to the real one. The real posterior distribution doesn't have these support points in it. It knows nothing about them. It's just a distribution over functions. They only exist in my approximation. And I have this scalar objective function that says, how close am I to the real distribution of a function? How close am I to the real posterior distribution? And these support points are just parameters of the approximation. So if I move them around and it increases my objective function, then great, I got closer to the real thing. It sort of goes contrary to what a lot of the literature says, but that really is our understanding of how this thing works. And empirically, you can show adding more of them, it doesn't get worse. Optimizing them works really, really well. Olivia?
So you have a big optimization problem. Do you know something about the properties of the functions that you optimize, and which optimizer do you use?
Yeah, there's a... So the optimizer I use depends on the problem. And I vaguely think about having two problems. First one is small enough to run on a laptop, like the one that I showed you. In that case, I use BFDS, because that works great. But for really big optimization problems, where I have to mini-batch the data to get a stochastic estimate of the gradient, I use this optimization technique called ADAM, which is an adaptive stochastic optimizer, like a Robbins-Monroe optimizer. It works very, very well. It's a really nice paper by a guy called Dirk Kingma explaining this method. And the other thing is we use preconditioning based on the Fisher information and the approximation. So because we're optimizing over distributions, we know something about the space of parameters we're optimizing over. We know that some parameters correspond to the mean of the distribution or the mean of the Gaussian process that we're optimizing, and some correspond to the variance. So there's a cool way to come up with a good preconditioner for the gradient that helps enormously. So this is sometimes called natural gradient descent. Henry?
Can you use the method to do what quite a few people are interested in, like spatially adapted?
covariance matrix, like, can you use it to actually get a posterior for the length scale and other covariance parameters?
Yes. So that I guess the thing that it can't do is always interpolate. So if you have 10,000 points and they're all completely noiseless, and you really, really want to interpolate them all, I can't interpolate them with only 1,000 support points. You know, it just can't be done, unless you get very, very lucky and they happen to lie on some manifold. But if there was a little bit of noise in there, a little bit of a nugget term, and one of the speakers earlier alluded to this as well, thanks for that. If there's a little bit of nugget term, if we're happy with that, then yeah, you can get very, very close with a reasonable number. And one of the really cool things here is because we're optimizing over where the support points are, and we're doing that in a rigorous way, we can get a lot more mileage out of each support point than if you just pick them. Okay.
Okay, in the interest of keeping time, I think I suggest that we continue the discussion later. Thank you very, very much for your
Thank you for inviting me.